So, Brian asked me when he was pulling together this symposium to summarize soil organic carbon research in urban areas. To do that in 20 or so minutes is not easy to do. So I kind of picked a theme to work around, and as it turns out, all the previous speakers kind of hit on a lot of the points I was going to make. And then Mitch, I figured no way Mitch is going to cover anything I was going to talk about, and then he brings up glucine. So by dumb luck, I'm going to actually summarize the symposium as well, hopefully you'll like it. So just would like to recognize my co-authors, and as the title suggests, we're going to take a global perspective. I'm going to look at multiple scales of observation of soil organic carbon in urban areas. But first, just taking a quick look at the number of publications in urban soil carbon, and we can see that we've taken a big leap over here, and so I think we should all congratulate ourselves, because it's amazing how much knowledge we've gained just in the last 15 years. It's really phenomenal, and some of the things I heard today are really phenomenal. So this is really, everybody should take credit for that. I'm not going to give an exhaustive summary of all that, just some highlights, so if your paper doesn't get cited or anything, I apologize. So I'm going to start with a very big perspective here, looking at global scale. If we look at the interchange of carbon between the atmosphere and the terrestrial carbon pools, basically there's two very important processes, the fixing of carbon by plants and net primary productivity, and then plants dying, shedding, root turnover, so on and so forth, goes into the soil organic pool, and that labile pool of carbon gets blown up pretty quickly, relatively speaking, to how long carbon dioxide lasts in the atmosphere, and so on and so forth. This is an old diagram. Anybody see anything really wrong with this picture? I mean, if the relative size of the atmospheric carbon pool to soil organic carbon, well, it should be the opposite. But anyway, it was drawn that way, I think, just to get it on the same slide. So there's two. So basically, precipitation and temperature has a controlling effect on both of those very important processes. So if you look at a global scale, I think Meintmeyer in 1985 et al., they were able to explain global soil carbon pools, you know, like 75% just using a potential evapotranspiration. But that's a very coarse scale. Now we can overlay this spatially on the globe, and we see that carbon stocks in soils actually vary quite a bit. Even though we're both the NPP and decay are controlled by climatic factors and of course, local factors, there's a huge variation in the amount of carbon that's out there in the landscape, and partly that is due to the fact that NPP and decay are differentially affected by these factors. So that's where we get this difference. And so a lot of work's been done in the last 5 years or so trying to estimate how much carbon's in soil, because it's a potential feedback in climate change if that carbon gets released into the atmosphere. This is a very good paper, Charlemagne et al., 2014. So they also presented a map showing the proportion of soil organic carbon to the total terrestrial carbon stock. And this suggests the importance of soil organic carbon right here. Almost in all cases, except for in the tropics, you're really, most of the carbon is being stored in the soil. Now what this suggests is that when we overlay people on this, right, humanity is becoming urban, when we overlay that on that map, it would stand to reason that those effects that we're having on those carbon pools are going to vary just as much as the amount of carbon that's varying in those soils, largely due, I propose, not only to climatic factors but also local factors. Soil parent material, for example, texture is very important, and so on, topography, drainage, and so on and so forth. So if we come closer to the Earth and we really want to get at how urbanization, urban land use change is having an impact on carbon cycles, We need to get closer to the earth. This is a conceptual diagram. I am not going to go through all this now, but just to give you an idea that it's very complicated, we think, anyway. So we break it down into indirect effects and direct effects. And the indirect effects are mostly changes that occur through land use, urban land use change that are environment and nature. And so we have length of growing season, for example, has been extended, higher concentrations of CO2, we know that. Nitrogen deposition, you know, basically climate change has already occurred in our cities kind of thing. Nighttime temperatures, which has an impact on plant respiration and so on and so forth. But these environmental changes have impacts on two very important components of the ecosystem, the plants, because they're the ones fixing the carbon, and the decomposer organisms, because they're breaking the stuff down. And so we can imagine that MPP is going to be impacted by these environmental factors. And also, as it turns out, the quality of the material is potentially impacted as well. And we can also think of the decomposer organisms being impacted. Invasive species of earthworms, for example, have been really important. Now, we look at the direct effects. This is when people go in and actually, you know, kind of move things around. They physically disturb the ecosystem. We manage ecosystems, so we supplement with irrigated water, nitrogen inputs, so on and so forth. Those potentially have even bigger impacts on soil organic carbon. And again, it's going to be played through the plant biomass and also through the decomposers. Now, when we have these direct effects, typically we have big changes in species composition, big changes in the plant species composition in urban landscapes, and that potentially has a really huge impact. So we take those two, oh, I'm sorry, one other thing I wanted to say about this, both of these conceptual models, we throw sealed surfaces in here, we're cutting off all those pathways. So it's a real huge impact when we do that. And so getting to soil heterogeneity, so we overlay those direct and indirect effects, we have what I like to think of as not necessarily more heterogeneity, but a new heterogeneity, because we just don't understand it. Because, and Brian, you really showed this well, all the old soil, you know, the soil factor equation and how we predict carbon out in the landscape, we could throw that out the window when people are out there in that landscape. Now, in some cases, there is going to be more complexity. But in cases where we're homogenizing, thank you, Tara, for bringing that up. When we're homogenizing landscapes, we're actually reducing, potentially reducing heterogeneity. But then again, we are out there managing parcels, and that might vary things quite a bit. So now what I'm going to do is kind of step through some scales, looking at some examples. This is, again, data from the literature, some data we collected in Baltimore. Some of it's about to be published, actually. A lot of it's old data you probably, some of you have already seen before. But we're going to look at the parcel scale where people are making decisions about managing their landscape, and so that has a lot to do with the social norms of a particular area. If you're in Phoenix, you know, some people are going to go xeriscaping, but a lot of people are going to want the plants they had when they lived in New York City or New York City metropolitan area. We're going to look at the metropolitan city scale. And in this case, development patterns have a really big impact, potentially, and also what's happening at the local scale. We're going to look at a continental scale where the local factors are going to have an important determination of what the net effect is going to be. And we're going to look at a global scale, looking at glucine results that we've just are about to get published. So we start with the local and parcel scale. We've already talked about, you know, how much turf there's out there. Residential areas make up about 40% of the urban landscape, city landscapes, according to NOAIC et al. But if you move out into ex-urban areas, that's probably going to go up. Malesi did a really nice, et al., did a nice job of quantifying how much turf is out there. What's really interesting and things that we know about at the local scale and parcel scale is that prior land use history has a huge impact on what we're seeing now for soil organic carbon pools. It depends a lot on that development process, how that worked, did they remove the topsoil, that sort of thing. But also if the prior land use actually denuded the soil carbon in those soils already. So a lot of times you get agriculture happening before urbanization. Those are really important. So one of my favorite papers over the years was this, and is it Kian? Is that how you pronounce that? Kian? Kian maybe? Anybody? I don't know. But Kian and Follett, 2002, they did a chronosequence of putting greens and fairways, lots of data, and we're able to show that after about 35 years, you get this rapid accumulation of carbon in these systems, and it kind of tops off about 35 years. And the rate up into that topping off was about 0.9 to 1.0 megagrams per hectare per year at the 0 to 10 centimeter depth. A lot of carbon being packed in there very quickly, a lot more rapidly than you'd find in a forest. And it's probably because of the high turnover that's going on in these systems, the relatively low carbon to nitrogen ratio, and so on and so forth, and the supplements that are going in there. Other folks have been finding pretty much the same thing. This 35 to 45 year threshold seems to be occurring a lot in the literature. Sometimes it's a little bit more, but this is Hewler et al., 2014. About 35 years, 0 to 10 centimeters, you top off, and they got about 0.5 to 1.0, so on and so forth. Townsend Small, in their paper, they got really high rates, but those are really heavily managed systems, and so on and so forth. And if we compare that to restored grasslands, you can see that these systems are really pumping in the carbon. Of course, when we assess these sequestration rates, we have to discount the emissions that we have to go through to get those turf grass systems to grow like that. And I would propose that when it starts to top off and we're not getting that sequestration anymore, that's when things really become a problem as far as the emissions. And so if these, as these turf grass systems age, we probably want to think about getting people not to as heavily manage them, because you don't even have to if you've already built that organic matter up in the soil. So turf is not the only thing in the landscape. There's other parts. This is a paper, Yesilonis et al. It's probably going to come out in the next issue of Urban Ecosystems, looking at a residential landscape and finding that there's a lot of a variation here in organic matter in the surface soils of these various patches that we were able to identify in this landscape, everything from raised mulch, unraised beds, to lawns, and we compared it to a nearby forest, and you can see going from lawn to raised mulch is probably a little bit of a management continuum there, and you're seeing a big buildup of carbon, and this suggests that there's potential here to pack in more carbon into these landscapes. And so Brown et al., 2012, looking at landscape part of these residential areas, found that you can get 1 megagram of carbon per hectare per year in these kinds of systems building up in those soils. What I found really interesting in their paper was that they estimated on the lower 48 that 57.6 teragrams per year of organic residues are produced in urban areas. And only 18.6 of that is being recycled. So we had the potential to take this material and get it back into the landscape and potentially create these hotspots of carbon accumulation. And so we've also done things like we've compared residential areas across very different climatic zones. This is Denver compared to Baltimore. This is Nancy Golubieski's data, so we kind of merged it with ours and got a paper out of it. And Nancy's had a chronosequence of about 40 years, and so that was the peak amount of carbon. Our lawns were a little bit younger, a little bit less, but what was really interesting is that when you compare it then to the native systems, that's for a short grass steppe where Denver is, you're getting a big buildup of carbon in those soils. Again, this was shown before by some other folks. But in Baltimore, not much of a big difference with the native forest type that used to be there. So now up to the city and metropolitan scale here, the development patterns and how much impervious surfaces you have out there and the nature of the green space is going to have a really big influence. But of course, all that is influenced by cultural, economic factors, and so on and so forth. The other thing about looking at a metropolitan area scale, we can test that idea of the indirect effects, looking at the environmental changes that come along with urbanization and how they're potentially impacting things. So these are long-term, these are our permanent plots in Baltimore, part of the Baltimore Ecosystem Study. These are real forests, one in an urban context, one in the rural. And I thought we were talking before about how context is really important. This is a good example. And so these are CO2 fluxes from forest floor. And we see that in the urban situation, we're getting higher fluxes of CO2 than the rural context forests. And we're actually getting a smaller sink for methane, and methane is a very important greenhouse gas. And we actually had very similar results in our New York City urban-rural gradient study. I don't have time to show that. Now, we take the same data for the methane, and we compare it to turf grass systems. Again, we have this environmental change, potential impact from the environment, but we also get this really big impact from a cover change and a management effect. So obviously, cover, you change cover and you manage heavily, you're going to get a big difference. And again, that would be a turf management gradient there, which I don't offhand know exactly what that was. And Kay et al., they had similar results in 2004. So if we look at the city scale, and this is what Bryant did. We broke it out for Baltimore. It didn't have that many cores, though. But we were able to get a pretty good estimate of by land use. This is carbon density, and we did it for soils and the trees. The trees came from iTree survey. We made a big assumption here, and this is where I'm beginning to realize we probably grossly underestimated, is the assumed under impervious is 3.16. when in fact some other folks are finding much greater. So what we're finding, though, is, again, those residential areas, we can pack in a lot of carbon. And so this is the work by Jill. Wonderful, wonderful research. I was very excited when this came out. Lots of data. This is what we actually need. But it really shocked me how much carbon they were getting in that landscape. Whereas we assumed 3.16, they were getting about 6.7 below impervious surfaces. Big difference there. And it really plays out differently as you look on a citywide scale. They also compared to arable soil, and you're getting increases in the urban again. So this seems to be quite consistent. What we'd like to do is be able to make these kinds of comparisons on a region-by-region basis and build in anthropogenic carbon emissions and compare them with the biogenic emissions and stocks and so on and so forth. And because we really feel that depending on the region, the context that you're in, region by region, that those results are going to be very different. That's why I had that. Now we're going to go to continental and regional. Cherkina et al. 2010, another great paper. Brought in the built environment, carbon that's stored there, looked at soils, vegetation, the available data. 10% of the land carbon, this is lower 48, stored in settlements, about 18 picograms. 64% of that was in the soil, and they were using our data. I was very happy that someone was able to use our data. This is a data set that we derived in 2006. It was very coarse. We're in the process of trying to update this all the time, and so right now, to get the native data, we're using NRCS. They have a new map out, a new database, FIA data, and so on and so forth, to do the same kinds of comparisons. We differentiated pervious from pervious and impervious, so we wanted to see exactly what was happening in those green spaces. But we also wanted to include the impervious. But again, we used a very low number for what's below the impervious, 3.16. We have the new data from NRCS. And just to show you, like, for example, Oakland, which is in more of a dry area, you're actually going to get a buildup of carbon in those systems relative to the native system that's there. Whereas in places like Syracuse, you get that reduction. So context is very important. So now we're going to go global. Last set of slides. Here, and thank you, Mitch, for bringing up Glucine. We start with five cities, and we have some of the lead PIs here in the audience. So when you ask me a question, I'll defer to them. And in these five cities, of course, we're looking at very different biomes in which they're nestled in, so the context is very much different. And basically, we broke the landscape up into various, we're calling soil habitat types. We only used a few, so ruderal is a very disturbed situation. Turf, we all know what that is. A remnant of the native system in the urban context, and then we're dealing with a reference site. And we're looking at soil organic carbon above, and this is the coefficient of variation, and we are getting convergence at these really broad scales. What this is suggesting is that through all five cities, if you look at a ruderal soil, it's pretty much the same soil organic matter content. Now, if we look at within the cities, we find that as you go from a reference to the more disturbed situation, it's the areas that have the most carbon in the native soils that change the most. They have the most to lose. Now, this is going to be consistent with what you guys are finding in that Potchefstroom, I don't think I'm saying that right, we're actually getting an increase in the turf system compared to the native system. And that makes sense because they're managing. They're overcoming those site limitations. So, there is one last slide. We're also looking at the microbial community. This is work by Dietrich Schmidt in conjunction with the glucine PIs, and Stephanie Yarwood is his advisor at the University of Maryland. And these here are the cities and the different patch types that we looked at. And this is a correspondence analysis showing the differences in the microbial communities. And we find that they're all converging as we disturb these soils into similar types. And so with the more recent understanding of long-term storage of carbon in soils, that a lot of it has to do with microbial processing, reformation of carbon into a much more recalcitrant form, that might make a really big difference in how long-term carbon storage is occurring in urban soils. So what have we learned thus far? And there's a lot here because of all those great and wonderful papers that I talked about before. So urban emissions, and I didn't show this slide because I didn't think I was going to have the time, but we had an Eduflux Tower in Baltimore ecosystem study. But basically, urban emissions are much greater than the carbon sinks in urban landscapes. And age matters. So as these turf systems are kind of topping out, they're not sequestering any more carbon, so that's why age matters. And urban carbon stocks vary widely. I took the lower, I didn't take that really, we had some really high values in New York City, but those were, we figured exceptions and not the rule, but now I'm beginning to realize that there's a lot more exceptions out there. So we have to revisit that. Urban soils store a lot more carbon and for longer periods than the urban phytomass, I would propose. That's true. Direct effects are much more important than indirect effects when it comes to carbon stocks and fluxes. Sealed surfaces inhibit soil carbon sequestration, but what I'm starting to see and hear in the literature is that these soils may be significant long-term sink for SOC. There's potential for that if these numbers are correct. Those are really high numbers. Much of the soil in urban landscapes, however, are below potential for storing organic carbon, so that would suggest that we had the potential to sequester more carbon in these soils. And seven, the net effects, you know, based on that context, is really important and what we're finding. And also urban soil organic carbon stocks, and I didn't mention this before, but if you look at the UK, for example, if you look at the Edmondson et al. Paper, you'll see that urban areas in the UK have a lot of carbon in their soils relative to the country, and it's a relatively small country, as opposed to the global scale, which urban areas don't cover that much. So so these stocks can be important. I'm not sure about the sequestration, though. That needs to be looked at. Okay, future research. Carbon stocks and fluxes, we need more data. We need to do the carbon density measurements. We need to get bulk density. We need to get fragments. No one really, well, yeah, I guess, Mitch, you mentioned wetlands too. There's a lot of carbon in wetlands, and as we urbanize the landscape, we're either burying those wetland systems or we're changing the hydrology of those wetland systems. And you showed the Florida data, we're actually losing carbon in those systems. We need more data on that. The amount and quality of carbon input inputs, and so this is where black carbon comes in, for sure. Exotic species, stress effects on plants might change their litter quality. Effects of urban environments such as calcium and nitrogen. I didn't talk too much about this, but studies have shown that N addition helps the humification process. Calcium in the formation of mollusols is an important. Fixes the humic acids. So we get a lot of calcium in urban soils. Maybe there's something going on there. Maybe we should take a closer look at that. And a few more, and then I'm done. We need to look at the long-term effects of the soil physical disturbances. So how can we speed the recovery, but also maintain the sequestration over a long period of time? Carbon stocks and fluxes of covered soils. We already kind of mentioned that. What's going on beneath those impervious surfaces is important. And I think Bryant really hit on this one. We need to go deeper. We have buried soils, sanitary landfills, and so on and so forth. Need to do that. And I also think we didn't talk much about emissions, but life cycle analysis is really important as we're maintaining. We know we can build carbon up in these systems, but what is the carbon emission cost for doing that? We really need to look at that over a very long period of time. And some people are starting to do that, but we need to do more. And this kind of goes with you, Mitch. How can we engineer these systems to capture more carbon? And lots of people to thank. That's it.